Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus. Today on Legends of Hercules, John Carl Pepe and I will be exploring the Celestials in the Marvel Universe. Greetings and welcome, my friend. How are you? I'm going to play a song. We seem to be having some technical problems. And welcome back to Legends of Hercules. I'm here with John Carl Pepe, and we're about to explore the mysteries of the Celestials in the Marvel Universe. Greetings and welcome, John. How are you?
Very good. Greetings and welcome. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm glad we had our technical difficulty resolved so quickly.
Sorry about that. Yeah. I had a microphone set up I was trying, and it had worked on a different test run, but for some reason I think with this setup it just wasn't working. So, but here we are now, onward and upwards.
And with the Eternals coming out in November and superhero movies doing well again in the movie theaters as well as streaming online, I'm really looking forward to the Eternals and how they contribute to the lore of the Celestials. They were in Guardians of the Galaxy and mentioned in some other movies, but now they're going to be explained, and I'm really looking forward to that.
Oh, definitely. And even today, a new teaser trailer or an extended trailer or something dropped for Eternals that had a little bit more footage, gave us a little bit more of what's going on in there, which is really cool. I think that movie is going to be, probably unlike any other film we have seen in the Marvel Universe, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which is funny because almost every film strives to be unlike something that you have seen in your traditional movie fare or the movies, in that cinematic saga that have preceded it. They just had tremendous success with Shang-Chi, which again plays more like an old school kung fu action epic, something a little new for Marvel. They did the spy genre before that with Black Widow earlier this summer, and it's neat if you kind of look at the Marvel Cinematic Universe and movie to movie, there's a lot of movies that sort of try to be some other type of movie. You think of like Ant-Man is like a heist movie, Winter Soldier is like a Flight of the Condor type political thriller or aspires to be. So I think that's one of the most fascinating things and one of the more effective things about what they're doing with the Marvel Cinematic Universe is every movie is sort of its own thing. And with the power of director Chloe Zhao, recently, you know, won the Academy Award, you know, behind this movie, even Kevin Feige, the celestial, we'll say, of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. He said her pitch was unlike anything he'd seen before. So this movie looks to be something special. Looks like it's going to do a lot, especially a lot of heavy lifting for the history of, on the cosmic level of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Much like the Eternals comic in 1976, created by Jack Kirby, did a lot of heavy lifting and gave us a lot of like deep dive background into the history of the Marvel Universe.
I loved that series when it came out. It was during the Ancient Astronaut craze, and Kirby had done the New Gods, and he was also doing a sequel to 2001, A Space Odyssey, in the comics.
Exactly.
And, so, yep. And he'd given birth to, of course, Olympus and Asgard, and it was a very Kirby-esque type of thing. And the Celestials have evolved since then, and now they've reached new levels of mythic heights in the Marvel lore.
Oh, as they've evolved insanely since then, and at times can be quite terrifying. In their portrayal and how they are utilized. The Eternals movie, we have yet to know exactly what their station is. Little background, I guess, for the uninitiated as to what, if you haven't seen Guardians of the Galaxy, at least, right? And you haven't read any of these 200 plus appearances of gigantic celestial beings in Marvel Comics, that's exactly what they are. They are gigantic celestial beings. Sort of, you know, when Stan Lee and Jack Kirby in Fantastic Four created Galactus, you were kind of like, you know, this is the world devourer. Galactus is this giant guy. He goes around and he eats worlds, right? And then they had also utilized that to introduce a character called the Watcher, right? The being who lives on the moon, who observes all of reality and multi-reality. And so those are really, I think, at that point in the early Marvel age of comics, the biggest of the big. They didn't really get in sheer size and scope of their mission statement, so to speak, they really get bigger than Galactus and the Watcher, and they're sort of polar opposites, right? One brings about destruction, and one just watches and has this vow of non-interference. And after a real healthy career that certainly was fraught with disagreements at times, of course, you know, as creatives are, Stanley and Jack Kirby, you know, they parted ways. Jack did the unthinkable in the early 70s, in 1970, 71. He left Marvel Comics and went to the rival, DC Comics, and that is where he brought us the New Gods and the Fourth World Saga and Darkseid and, you know, all these great characters that are also starting to see, more exposure in multimedia. And as you noted before, you know, Jack Kirby, worked heavily on Thor and created this whole world of Asgard using the actual myths, the actual surviving myths of Norse mythology, and then tailor making them fit for the greater Marvel universe, so that it all, you know, all was like this nice big tapestry that Jack was wielding. And with the New Gods, as we've talked about before, it almost seemed like he was destroying that. Ragnarok had come, and these are the gods that are after, you know, Asgard and the Norse gods. This was the New Gods concept that he did. The old gods died, the new gods arose, and his relationship with DC was all too brief. Again, disagreements sometimes get in the way of creative visionaries and no-nonsense guys like Jack Kirby, So he goes back to Marvel and does a few things with Marvel. You know, you'd think he would just go right back to what he was known for, and he did. He did. You know, he was working on Captain America for, you know, when he went back, but also did this incredible and insane adaptation of 2001: A Space Odyssey. And for, you know, Marvel decided to make this an ongoing. It wasn't just like a 4-issue adaptation of the movie. It was an ongoing title that was full Jack Kirby, which also brought us things like the a great character, Machine Man, right? Really, really cool character that has also become tied to the Celestials in various interpretations as well, partly because they both, you know, came from Jack's imagination, but also because of that 2001 connection as well, which I'll get to in a minute. So mid-1976, he does the Eternals, and, you know, we did a whole episode about the Eternals, and you know, I always felt like what Jack Kirby did with the Eternals was sort of what Alan Moore did to the Charlton characters in Watchmen, except Jack Kirby was doing that with the Greek mythological pantheon. I mean, again, the Eternals, they're called Olympians, right? You know, and each one sort of feels has a counterpart in classic Greek mythology. I thought was really cool. Plus the whole idea of how there's Eternals, there's humans, and there's deviants, and the Eternals are locked in this battle, an eternal battle, if you will, against the deviants to protect the advancement of humankind. And excuse me. And the great thing that he brings to the table, and again, this is Jack Kirby going full on Chariots of the Gods, full on Eric von Daniken. This idea that if you thought Galactus was the biggest dude in the universe, no, there's a whole race of bigger dudes called the Celestials, and the Celestials, basically their job is to muck with civilizations and create races and plant seeds throughout the universe and sit back and watch the experiment happen. So in that point, they're sort of, you have this really cool triangle or triumvirate of these guys who do these certain, you know, you have Galactus, the devourer, the watcher, you know, who watches, observes, non-interferes, and then the Celestials who directly are just like, we are just going to mess around and just see what we can create.
And now the Eternals, the Celestials, and even the Watcher have found themselves into the MCU canon. The Watcher most recently on the What If television program, and it looks like he's making a multi-dimensional or a multiverse Avenger team.
Yes, I'm glad you brought this up. This What If series, I'm going to call it the Watcher series because really that's what it is. But this What If series has been really full of a lot of surprises. And one of the things that was great that they stuck on you is that you go into it thinking it's just all self-isolated stories, that it's just going to be, you know, there's going to be no carryover. And then things start to slowly percolate or run through specific things until this past episode where, we've got full-on acknowledgement that all of these shows are now tied together. You actually got the Watcher to break his vow of non-interference because really that's what a character comes in and says, I must not interfere, you know. At some point, he's going to interfere. That's just storytelling, right? The Watchman does have a history of getting involved, as it were, in the actions of the heroes, either by helping them indirectly or even directly getting involved. So this most recent episode, it's a full-on brawl between the Watcher and Ultron . And basically it looks like the next two episodes are going to see the building of a multiversal Avengers, and we're going to see how they go out on that first season of this What If. But what a nice surprise that show has turned out to be, and really again opened the door to the greater cosmic Marvel universe. which had been really in the movies in the MCU relegated really more to the Guardians end of it, and then it sort of does invade, you know, in Infinity War. But a lot of the Marvel stuff, you know, has wisely been grounded on Terra Firma. Mm-hmm. But, you know, again, using the Celestials, Guardians of the Galaxy does a great job of illustrating exactly who the Celestials are and what their basic function is. And there's a neat set piece, you know, neat concept in there that the nowhere, right, the place of bartering,
yeah,
where the collector has is actually inside the head of a Celestial, which is a really cool, great concept. And then even in Guardians of the Galaxy 2, if I remember correctly, Kurt Russell's character of Ego, the Living Planet, claims to be a Celestial, even though I don't think that's the case in the comics. But he does claim to be a Celestial,
yes.
And that would then make Peter Quill, Star-Lord, half Celestial, and that's great because that allows him to achieve a lot of things that need to be achieved for the function of the story. But again, makes him sort of a deeper character as well.
I was surprised
and the
when
reason
he did that, and because he's not equated with the Celestials in the comic books.
Right, right. Well, I mean the Peter Quill, you know, Star-Lord in the comics. Vastly different from what we've seen in the movies. And I think it was Brian Michael Bendis' run on Guardians of the Galaxy that just preceded the movie that edged him towards that sort of Han Solo-esque, snarky, sarcastic space pirate, you know. Whereas in the comics, he was the son of an alien prince, I believe, and there was some sort of, you know, inherent specialness about him, but nothing of the grandeur of making him the son of Ego and really sort of like a celestial chosen one, so to speak, a celestial hybrid.
Right.
Which again, I think we're going to see a really nice payoff for that in the upcoming Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, because by all accounts, that is James Gunn is saying this is a trilogy, and you know I'm gonna take a lot of these toys with me when I'm done. So apparently, it's going to be pretty sad. Also, this final Guardians when we finally get it. So.
Yes, but they had earlier versions of the Guardians in the Guardians of the Galaxy film with Sylvester Stallone playing
yes.
a part in that. And there have been other iterations of the Guardians, so the Guardians themselves might continue. Thor also called them the Asgardians of the Galaxy, which was a comic book series as well. So who knows?
Yeah, and again, you know, with the possibility of what if doing well enough, you know, you can kind of explore these concepts that maybe aren't going to make it to the screen, either in just an animation that exists within the Marvel Cinematic Universe proper, or you know, this burgeoning multiverse. Because I think they're really going to, based on things that I've heard from, you know, the recent Venom movie and. You know what we've seen in the Spider-Man trailer. I think we're gonna, you know, they're gonna be able to use this concept of the multiverse to just bring in everything if they need it, when they want it, and just, you know, have it just be that, oh, I'm from that multiverse, you know. So
yeah,
so that, you know, we'll see where they go with that. And again, all these concepts, they have a tendency to stick around, you know? So yeah, I'm sure once James Gunn has done his Guardians trilogy, yeah, there will be some sort of reworking, rebranding, passing of the torch, and we'll probably see something like that. And, you know, yeah, it was great that they acknowledged the other Guardians, you know, by having
yeah.
Sylvester Stallone and those other guys in that tag. But those, they're the Guardians from the future, right? They're the ones, including, that's where Yondu comes from, right? That iteration of the Guardians, the first iteration of the Guardians, they were a team in the far, far future. It was, I think, at about with the Abnett Lanning stuff that they did, I think, in the 90s, through the early 2000s, that sort of brought the Guardians to where Bendis could bring it even further as far as that development of Peter Quill to be what we recognize and what they've used for the movie. But we digress. The Guardians, though, those two movies are a lot of fun, and again that whole bit with the Celestials is very important, especially to what we've got coming up with the Eternals, which, from what we've seen from the trailer, basically it's the Eternals in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. They are they have been here for thousands of years. They are here to protect humanity. They haven't, because they haven't been told to by the Celestials, who are responsible for them being here. And we've seen, some great, deviance action, some Eternals fighting deviance, in the trailers. Looks like this movie, as big of an action movie it's going to be, it's also going to be very grounded, it looks like. And there's going to be, I think, a lot of emotional work, a lot of deep character work that I am expecting from this movie as well.
There's one contradiction in there that they haven't explained sufficiently, and other people have pointed it out, but I noticed this very quickly. During one of the trailers that they released, they said that they weren't allowed to interfere unless it had to do with the deviants. But then Thanos himself is, although he's immaternal, he has the deviant gene. So wouldn't his destroying half the universe fall under their responding to deviant threats?
Right, right. Well, and so here's the thing, though, is do they go so far in the cinematic universe to make that connection, to connect Thanos that deeply into the Eternals? Or have we just kind of, have we used Thanos to the degree that he is effective on screen? Now, granted, What If has shown us, yes, that there can be life for Thanos outside of, his evilness, right? His twirling mustache evilness, and again, the character work on Thanos as well. Yes, he was a mustache twirling villain, but he believed he was right. He believed in what he was doing, and was a very sympathetic villain. And those are always the best villains, the sympathetic villains. So that's a good question. I think that is a valid point. And will it be something that is explained, or will it just sort of be, the comic Thanos is deeply tied into the Eternals. The movie Thanos, there's really no connection there at all.
I don't know, though, because in the comic book series that they just started, they've tied Thanos very much to the fate of the Eternals. And in fact, the way it looks like it's going with coming issue descriptions and ads, Thanos is going to wind up ruling the Eternals for a while.
Yes, absolutely. And again, makes perfect sense within that narrative world of the comic, and I think it is something that can be utilized and done in the movies as well. And so again, that is that is something that maybe is designed to spark that conversation, and that is something that will be answered down the road, right? Because if this movie does well, there's going to be more movies with the Eternals,
right?
And getting Josh Brolin, back, in the game, I think is not very hard to do, because he has spoken fondly of his work there, and as I think even expressed an openness to wanting to come back as well. They're opening up a multiverse of possibilities. So anything is possible. And also, you brought up an interesting point about the trailer, how, there were, I think, two different lines of dialogue used in two different trailers at the same moment. And that's something that happens all the time.
Yes.
And they almost do it
deliberately
in the Marvel trailers. Again, Kevin Feige like made a point for the Infinity War trailer to throw fake scenes in there,
right?
Just so people would be surprised, you know, when it doesn't happen, right? So I think that's I always love the trailers because they always give us such a great taste of what we're gonna get to see. But I always watch a trailer with some skepticism as to what is that even gonna be in the movie, you know? So I always find that funny with the Marvel trailers that they're almost designed to trip you up, right?
But it is
a great point, and I would love to see, you know, especially if these characters are really well done and fully realized, and this movie does such a really good job. I would love to see more, and I would love to see that Thanos connection explored, because you're right, you know, they're beyond just the story and sales reason. You know, they have been using Thanos very heavily. In fact, the Eternals monthly has sort of paused for the last couple months, and there was a Thanos one shot, and then this coming Wednesday will be a Celestia, an Eternals Celestia one shot.
Oh, really?
Now you're reading the this coming Wednesday, I believe, is the Celestia one shot.
I didn't see that on the website. I have to look for it. I thought Icarus was coming sometime during the month, but I didn't know there was a Celestia one.
Yeah, you know, I feel like I saw that on the website this morning, but I know I've seen a print ad for it in the Marvel books as well. I think we'll both have to take a quick look right now while we talk. So I think it's really cool that they are, they're doing these sort of one shots on the Eternals book, just to sort of give you a little breather between, you know, what was apparently a very solid 6-issue, you know, story arc. And then to set up, which I think is going to be another really large, really big story arc. Now, you have been reading The Eternals, correct?
Yeah. That's the last one I read. And I'm enjoying it so far. It's different. And it's kind of re-envisioned what The Eternals were all about. That started during one of the series where The Eternals discovered their true purpose and wound up killing each other. That was during the run.
Yeah, that was I think the Neil Gaiman, John Romita Jr. Miniseries, which I think they're pulling some of that, I believe, for the Eternals movie as well. This sort of awakening, you know, and gathering, going across the world to gather everyone together. Just so you know, yes, Eternal Celestia. Slated to come out this Wednesday at.
Oh wow! I have to go back to the website. Yeah. I must have missed that one, so I have to go back.
Yeah.
And
so tell me, who is the Celestia character in the current Eternals monthly?
I don't remember.
Oh, okay, right on. Well, they're gonna give you the straight dope and the lowdown on her this coming Wednesday. So. That looks to be another big piece of the Celestials in the Eternals comic, and they've played a role in the Eternals comic up to this point in the current monthly, correct?
The Celestials have not been there. Thanos has found a way of screwing with the Eternals. They did the Eternals to be like the Cylons in the re-envisioned Battlestar Galactica, where they get downloaded and into another body and come forth. Then in Galactica, somebody started messing with the resurrection chambers and the ships wouldn't work. The same thing they're doing here. So if an Eternal dies, they might not resurrect. Zuras is out of the way. Some of the other ones are out of the way. And one of the Eternals, I don't remember who exactly, I think it's Hephaestus. He is the one helping Thanos. So it was quite a surprise. Hephaestus, yes. He's the one helping Thanos. So it's different, and the world seems to be a sort of computer, and there's just a lot of information there. So right now I'm drawing a blank, but I'm at the Joker's site right now, so I'm going to find it.
Yeah, because there's it looks like there's a celestial looming in the background of that cover, gorgeous painted cover again by Esad Rebek. So maybe this is the opening salvo of a big celestial eternal story arc to sort of coincide with the movie coming out November 5th, actually.
Right around the corner.
Right around the corner. Yeah, absolutely. And and so again, it's just, you said you wanted to do the Celestials, I was like, oh, this is going to be, this is great because there's so much of these guys. Little realizing how much these guys have been used throughout. I only really had a couple of stories that I truly remembered and really liked. One of my first real exposures to the Celestials was the Thor run. Right after Walt Simonson left, and he did this mega run, Ragnarok, and then Asgard gets restored. Did a great job of putting the toys back in the toy box. And Tom DeFalco and Ron Frenz, and Ron Frenz was being inked by Joe Sinnott, and then I think later Brett Breeding. I think that was the order how that worked out. And Ron Frenz is one of my favorite artists of that era. We're talking about the mid to late 80s, early 90s, because Ron Frenz would whatever title he was working on, he would always do his best to mimic the original artist, right? So when he was working on Amazing Spider-Man, he was drawing in a very Steve Ditko style. Then when he do Thor, he was channeling Kirby all over the place. And the first major story arc, or the first main story arc that they did, had Thor going up against the Celestials. And I remember Walt Simonson had introduced this really cool armor for Thor at the time, and he really looked very mythological, right? Very much like the Thor of myth, even with the big belt and the gloves and everything. And he also gave Thor the beard. And I remember the first thing that DeFalco and Frenz did was they got rid of the beard, but they did keep the armor for a spell.
I remember
Thor going up against it was great. It was like there was like the troll on the with the razor on the as the splash page. It's like, I'm gonna get you, Thor, and then it's like you turn the page. It's like, now sit still so I can shave that beard off. One of those great openings of a comic. That worked so well in that medium. And remember, Thor goes off and finds this planet. I think it's like a very peaceful, idyllic planet, if my memory is serving me correct. But the Celestials have come to judge the planet. And they have judged the planet, not worthy, and they want to wipe it out and start anew. And Thor stands up to these, cosmic bullies as he uh-huh. considers them. They have no right to do this. And they blast Thor, and I remember I believe that they destroy Mjolnir, and all that is left is just the handle. They obliterated the actual hammer part of Thor's hammer, and Thor being Thor, that doesn't stop him. He charges at him, still just using the handle of Mjolnir. And I remember that distinct imagery of Thor just without the hammerless hammer just still going after him, and I remember the resolution to that being very cosmic, very very kind of heady for
I believe that they went back to Norse mythology, but they also changed the whole relationship between the Eternals, the Celestials, and the Marvel Universe. They kind of created a blending, something that Kirby was not really enthusiastic about doing. He wanted them separately.
Yes, yes, yep, yep. Yeah, he kind of did want it to kind of be in its own pocket, yeah. But, I still enjoyed that that exposure to these beings, as far as, you know, in a contemporary comic book at that time, reading it month to month. Again, that cliffhanger of Thor's hammer getting shattered, you know, which, you know, again, has happened many times before and many times since then. But, you know, in the age before the internet, you know, you're there, you know, when you're reading something off the rack, that immediacy, and it's just like, oh my gosh, this has never happened before, you know. And Marvel was always really good at that illusion of change without really changing, you know. You know, get having characters lose their costumes only to wind up back in their classic, you know, interpretations, you know, down the road when someone's run came to an end or whatnot. So, and Thor was no stranger to that. Many iterations of Thor, and definitely many times where the hammer has been, you know, destroyed or passed along or whatnot. But for me, just, you know, kind of really getting into Thor at that time, I'm like, this is great. This is so cool. I've never seen this before. You know, and then again, they think in the Black Galaxy saga, aren't the Celestials, yes, do the Celestials figure in that one as well? And again, that's pivotal to Hercules's trajectory,
right,
through the Marvel Comics universe. You know, after being kind of uncharacteristically beaten to a pulp by Mr. Hyde, because his hotheadedness apparently gets the better of him in that Brotherhood of Evil storyline in the Avengers. Hercules comes back in the Evolutionary War, where he then saves the day in that one, but by becoming hyper-evolved. And then Black Galaxy Saga brings him and the High Evolutionary back,
right,
with the Celestials also at play in there. And again, that was also part of that Tom DeFalco, Ron Friends run, because again, these guys were really good at playing the long game. Because, you know, when they are using the Celestials in their first arc together, you know, they're setting it up for that Black Galaxy saga. Just like when they introduced Eric Masterson a good, you know, couple, 3 years before he even start, you know, before he becomes the new Thor at that time. The illusion of change without really change. but yeah, the Tom DeFalco and Ron Friends really did some great seed planting earlier in their runs that paid off later on.
And Hercules becomes a form of a Celestial, something Thor becomes in the Thorian amalgam that we talked about.
Right.
We have Hercules in the Marvel Universe several times, including Bob Layton's run toward the end becoming, mm-hmm, a type of Celestial. It seems that humans or demigods can aspire to become Celestials, or can wind up becoming Celestials in the Marvel Universe.
Yeah. And again, that sort of tracks with the mythological Hercules, because we, you know, he ascends into the sun, right? So to speak, essentially, in, you know, a very, very rudimentary interpretation of it, but he's sort of become like the sun god. You know, he does go through an ascension as well.
Yeah.
Which makes him, you know, he transcends demigodhood and becomes sort of a true celestial being. So again, having that happen to him in the comics, yeah, that's great, because it does track. But again, they have to keep bringing him back too. So,
very true.
Yeah.
Change, the more they stay the same in comic book universes, and alas, sometimes in our lives as well.
Like 20 years ago, I was working at a comic book shop. And you know, I've had a lot of jobs in the intervening 20 years, but I've wound up back working at a different comic shop. But you know, yeah, kind of interesting how things do bookend themselves like that, you know. So the other big story that somebody on Facebook actually brought up when you announced this episode a week or so ago was the Earth-X storyline. And
yes,
this is that, you know, and again, there's that whole idea of, you know, the illusion of change without really changing. Earth-X was sort of, you know, there was a while when there was no What If comic, right? As people don't know, the What If TV show based on a great comic from the 70s and 80s, you know, called What If, and it did just that. It asked crazy questions of, you know, what if Thor fought Conan? What if Conan walked the earth in the present day? Things that, of course, have actually come true in the actual Marvel comics as well. And that, you know, yeah, and there's a lot of plot points, story points that were introduced in What If that did actually wind up becoming canon down the road, you know, by other writers and whatnot. I think even the Invaders. The Invaders was initially, I think, a What If concept. Or the Avengers of the 1950s. I mean, that was what there was an Avengers in the 50s, and then that sort of got slotted into proper Marvel continuity. So What If has been great fodder for, you know, for decades. And one of the, but there was a period where there was no What If. And so Marvel would do just stories that would, sort of be a all geared towards the future, right? There was a lot of the Marvel The End books, right? Each character had a The End book that sort of would be their final story and how they went out, you know. And there was a huge, ambitious series. It was a trilogy called the Earth-X Trilogy. And this was the brainchild of the great Alex Ross. Alex Ross, if you don't know, is a phenomenal artist who grew up in, you know, cut his teeth in the Bronze Age of comics, you know, Silver Age, Bronze Age of comics, and, you know, watched all the classic comic shows on TV, and in his art style, he reflects that, right? He does a wonderful, he's like the Norman Rockwell of comics, right? He does these beautiful, you know, lush watercolor type or oil type, I don't know, great paintings, right? And he even does comics in this painting style. And he's all about the mythology, and he's all about making these characters bigger than life but grounded. So when he does a painting of Batman, we'll say, you know, he doesn't do the armored Batman that we see in live-action interpretations. He does a guy in tights, you know. You know, it's, but he grew up, you know, with that the old Shazam show, you know, and so whenever he paints Shazam, he's just painting that costume from the old show, you know, the live action show from the 70s, you know. That's sort of his methodology, his sort of trademark, right? So he's a phenomenal artist and a great visionary, and he had the opportunity to do a great story for DC with a wonderful writer, Mark Waid, called Kingdom Come. And Kingdom Come was... Yeah, really great series, sort of a Twilight of the Gods, right, for DC, a possible future where heroes, you know, come out of retirement, and it's an old generation versus a young, disrespectful heroic generation. It's a really phenomenal work, though. It's really, really a real high bar standard, especially when you're looking for, you know, things like that fall into the Dark Knight Returns, you know, the possible future of a beloved character. And this, you get a bunch of characters. So after they did the Kingdom Come miniseries, Alex Ross decided to do sort of the same thing with Marvel. And he came up with these amazing designs for future versions of the Marvel characters. One of my favorite was the Spider's Man, right? Because it was a guy who was turned into a spider creature, but he had like this leathery skin that looked like Spider-Man's costume. It was red and looked like the webbing. It was really cool. It's really, you check this stuff out because it's some really great character design work. And he did, so this was all for a future, you know, a look at a possible future of the Marvel Universe called Earth-X. And that was like a 12 or 13 issue series. He co-wrote it with his writing partner, Jim Kruger. And he didn't illustrate the interiors. The late John Paul Leon, a wonderful artist in his own right, who left us all too soon about a month or two ago. He did the interiors, does a bang up job on that, especially because his art style is very light and shadow. So heavy inks and negative spaces, very much, and you know, you don't look at him and be like, oh, he can interpret Alex Ross's stuff, no problem. But he does a really good job taking Alex Ross's hyper-realistic style and making it work for himself and on his own, and taking these character designs and really doing a great job with it as well. And Alex Ross does fully painted covers. And now this is a trilogy. It was Earth X, Universe X, and Paradise X. I've only read the first part. This is a 20-year-old series, too. I've only read the first part. I've only read Earth X.
I haven't even read that
fascinating.
Yet. You're ahead of me.
Oh, yeah. Fascinating. Really, I mean, again, Alex Ross knows this stuff backwards and forwards. So he is doing deep dives into Machine Man, the 2001 stuff that Kirby put in there, you know, pulling all of the Eternals continuity and all the just the minutiae even of just the Marvel Universe writ large, right? And he pulls this all together, and basically the idea is the Terrigen Mist that were responsible for creating the Inhumans, right? Yeah. The Terrigen Mists go off worldwide, and so now humans are gaining powers. And again, it's very similar in that respect to Kingdom Come, where then what are the old heroes doing while these new superpowers are coming through? It sort of culminates with the Celestials coming down to create final judgment on humanity. You have Reed Richards plays heavily in it because he's always the smartest guy in the room. You have a Galactus has died, and Franklin Richards is the new Galactus. And so it's just real heady, real amazing stuff that I know I definitely think it deserves a rereading because it has been so long since I had a chance to really dive deep into it. But it's I remember it being very moving and just a real wonderful, love letter again to the Marvel Universe. The only way Alex Ross knows how, by tearing it apart and rebuilding it again.
Wow.
Yeah.
There's so much. It's a continuous myth-making machine, not just Marvel, but all the comic book companies. And every now and then they redefine themselves. So it's very difficult to keep track of everything. And following a couple of stories, you have to wait till somebody explains it to say, oh, yeah, I should read that, and then go.
I didn't even do that justice.
Wow.
It's
got me very curious about it.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely worth checking out. Because I wanted to touch on this before, because I think it's one of the greatest things that Jack Kirby has ever done, both in the cinematic world and the comic world. And I think this is also touched on in Earth X, which I think was where I first realized it was a thing. Mm-hmm. Jack Kirby actually goes so far as to say that the large black monolith from 2001 Space Odyssey was created by the Celestials. And that is a thing that I think Kirby insinuated in there, and I think other people have taken that ball and run with it as well. But that idea that part of the Marvel Universe, and that is an object created by the Celestials, that Jack Kirby was able to kind of weave that all of that in there. Because again, with that 2001 Space Odyssey comic, once he was done with the movie, he had free reign to do whatever he wanted. And
right.
So, yeah, he kind of was starting to feed these ideas into his own little corner of the cosmic Marvel Universe that he was working in at that point in the mid-70s. And again, like we were saying, heavily influenced by Eric Van Daniken, really just all these concepts is like, this is, I'm going to put this on the page, and
he did it creatively, too. he didn't just stick with what Von Däniken had said. He took it into his own Kirby world and translated it and made it something different and in many ways grander than what it was before.
Sure, and, you know, in some ways you have to think, like, the way that Jack was working, you know, even on this big cosmic tapestry back in the 60s, you have to wonder, like, were these concepts that he himself had come on, you know, on his own or had sort of been like, oh, yeah, that's, yeah, maybe that is the thing, you know, and then all of a sudden, you know, Chariots of the Gods comes out and it sort of gives validity to a lot of these comic book concepts that he was playing with a decade before, you know, so you almost got to wonder, like, because he didn't just, you know, rip Van Däniken and put that on in his work, that he did his own Kirby spin on it, that these are concepts that he was thinking about well before, you know, Chariots of the Gods even came out.
He seemed to be familiar with the Shaver mystery, because a lot of the tale of the deviants and the Eternals comes from the Shaver mystery, and also theosophy. Mm-hmm. He seems to have been well-read in theosophy, because a lot of the concepts that are in theosophy found their way into the comic, too. So if you're familiar with all these esoteric things, the Eternals was like, oh, wow.
And again, which I think I've mentioned this before, blows my mind, because when you think of Jack Kirby and you know what Jack Kirby looks like and you hear these stories of Jack Kirby, he don't seem like that guy. You know, he seems like my grandfather telling me to turn off the Incredible Hulk TV show because it's phony baloney and he'd rather watch the A-Team. That's who Jack Kirby seems like to me, you know.
That's certainly what he looked like in his presentation of himself, but his imagination formed pantheons, and pantheons that are beyond the comic book now and into movies, and they've had a dramatic effect on our larger culture. So he's like a Homer of this day and age, giving
100%. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, it's again, we're blessed to have had people like this inform our creative endeavors and our you know, fictional escape, you know, ism. Because, you know, without what he put on the page, we always go back to Jack Kirby, but, you know, he fits so right into the cosmic milieu, as well as the modern mythology, with just such a healthy nod to the past, you know, to past mythology, that he as a creator is just unparalleled, and I think that everybody can pretty much agree with that. You know, if you've picked up a comic, you owe that reading experience in some way to Jack Kirby.
That can definitely be said, and he had a part in the creation of many of the heroes that are now in the Marvel Universe, and he certainly gave them more epic scope to the heroes that he didn't create or help create.
Yeah, and now it kind of comes a little full circle, because 45 years after he gave us the Eternals number one, they're a big movie, release coming up. And, you know, unfortunately he's not around to see it, but, you know, if what we believe to be is true, he's looking down and he's smiling at this, you know, anticipatory release. He's probably a little upset that it's being tied into the greater Marvel Cinematic Universe at large, but he's very happy that there's Eternals action figures on the toy shelves right now, you know.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
That is incredibly awesome. Yeah. I don't know if we'll be collecting all of them, but I will be collecting select ones that I've decided already.
Yeah, they look really nice. They look really good. I have to curb the habit a little bit, so I'm going to have to draw the line on these. Although I saw that the Gilgamesh is the Build-A-Figure, and I'm like, oh, man, that's how you get me. You get me with the Build-A-Figure. So, but no, actually, there's that retro Marvel Legends Hercules should be starting to hit the shelves in the next month or so. So that's definitely something to look forward to. And, you know, a lot of good stuff coming down the aside from the Eternal Celestia one-shot coming out this Wednesday. There's another Sumerian adaptation of Robert E. Howard's work coming up. First chapter also comes out this Wednesday. So there's some good stuff in the immediate and the not too far future.
And they've given Conan a break, Conan the Barbarian, and they're starting Conan the King in December.
Yep.
It's good that they're coming out with that.
Well, that issue, the Legacy 300, issue 25 of Conan was really good because it was different stories from each era, ending with a King Conan tale, rolls right into the 6-issue King Conan miniseries. So, I like that. I like that they're doing it that way. And then we'll see what's down the pike after that for Conan. So
some of the stories, they were well written and I enjoyed them. I was very entertained. But they've done it before. Like they had Conan fighting his younger self and his much older self before the original Marvel run of Conan. And they've had him very old before also in the Dark Horse runs.
I mean, again, it's, you know, but you know, look, someone hasn't read it. Someone hasn't read that story before. I mean, look, there's some great concepts that you always got to go back to them. And it's always nice to see other writers take their spin on similar concepts as well, to see how other writers handle it. And, yeah, the hook for this King Conan, again, is this is after the what we know to be the final Conan story. So, so Marvel's trying to, Marvel's kind of doing, like we were talking about, the end series. This is like a Conan the End coming up. But looks good. Good art team, good writing team on there. So, yeah.
And we come to the point of the program where we have to wrap up. So if you can kindly share how people can contact you and find their way to the Joker's Child, that would be awesome.
Sure. Yeah, of course. So we always like to talk about the Joker's Child, 12-23 River Road, Fairlawn, New Jersey. Just, you know, over 34 years operating Len and Karen. They run such a tight ship. They do their best to get you what you want. And it's always just a great place to come, get some comics, and, you know, talk some nerd stuff for a while, too. So Joker's Child, Fairlawn, New Jersey.
I always like going there, especially like when you're there and we get to chat in person for a few minutes.
Yes.
It's a place to go, and it's a great place to get comics. It's my personal comic book store, and I can't recommend it enough. And thank you again for your encyclopedic knowledge of all things comic book. I enjoyed speaking with you. I enjoyed learning from you, and I'm already looking forward to our next conversation.
Same here. Thank you.
Be well, my friend, and until next
you
time,
too.
Joyous journeys and amazing adventures. Same goes to the folks who tuned in, whether you called in and you're in our queue, whether you clicked on a link and found yourself here, or whether you're enjoying us on demand at some later time. Thank you for tuning in, and we wish you joyous journeys and amazing adventures as well. As Stan Lee would say, Excelsior.
Excelsior. There you go. Take care.
Take care. You too. And we're going to close with Mighty Elohim by Linnell Griffin. Linnell is a musician whose music is picking up in popularity, and I'm very honored that she allows us to share it here on the show.